Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas is now in session pursuant to adjournment.
Thank you. Be seated. The court has three matters this morning for submission on its oral docket. In the order of their presentation, they are as follows. Daniel Johnson and others versus James Linnall and others from Walker County. Dan Boyles Jr. versus Susan Kerr from Harris County, and Valerie W. Davenport versus the Honorable Carolyn Garcia, an original mandamus proceeding. The court has assigned times for all of these arguments. The attorneys have been so advised. Attorneys for petitioners or appellant may, or relator may, designate a certain amount of time by speaking with the marshal for rebuttal argument. We will take a brief recess in between the presentation of each of these causes, but we will complete the entire oral docket before taking our lunch break. Counsel are advised that these arguments are being recorded for the convenience of the court. You may make application with the clerk of our court should you desire to hear the tapes of these arguments. I have voluntarily recused in the third cause to be argued this morning, and Justice Gonzalez will preside over that argument. Court is now ready to hear argument from petitioners in Johnson versus Linnall.
May it please the court, petitioners will be represented by Mr. Barry J. Brooks. Mr. Brooks is reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, my name is Barry J. Brooks. I'm appearing at the request of the court on behalf of petitioners Daniel Johnson and William Biggs. The court has requested that we limit argument only to the point of error number 3 raised by petitioners in their original appeal. That point of error addresses the constitutionality of Section 13.001 of the Civil Practices and Remedies Code. It is petitioner's position that Section 13.001 is unconstitutional because it has two fundamental defects. First, it denies paupers equal access to the courthouse. And secondly, it allows dismissal of causes of action without a hearing, without notice, or without any opportunity to respond to the court's action. With respect to the first point, I would point out that Section 13.001 is only applicable to paupers. By its very statement, it says only when an affidavit of inability has been filed under 145 can the court consider dismissing an action. The court can consider dismissing this action before service is even had upon the other side. It is our position that this violates Article 1, Section 13 of the Texas Constitution, which provides that the court shall be open to all persons seeking to redress their grievances. There's been very little case law in the state of Texas on this issue. Probably the only one that would get close to it would be Dillingham versus Putnam, a very old 1890 Supreme Court case involving the use of a supersedious bond. In that case, this court determined that using some sort of economic means to limit access to the courthouse would be inappropriate and unconstitutional. It is petitioner's position that that is applicable to this situation. Petitioners would urge that what is involved here is a fundamental right to bring a lawsuit, not necessarily to maintain the lawsuit, and there are some cases that go off on open court's provision with regards to maintaining the lawsuit, whether or not a statute of limitations bars you, whether or not there are notice provisions, other instances of that nature which go to being able to maintain or continue your lawsuit. This right that we are talking about is the fundamental right to just bring your lawsuit, have the other side served, and then get into court.
13.001 does not prohibit you from bringing a lawsuit, does it?
It effectively does, because you don't even get service if the judge determines that the case is frivolous. The procedures outlined are that a case can be filed, if you will, but before you can even get the constable or the clerk to issue service or the constable to go out and serve it, a judge can look at those pleadings, just those pleadings, and say, at this point, I've decided this is frivolous, therefore, I'm just saying, let's don't file it at all. Or, excuse me, let's not file, let's not serve it.
And that, I take it, is an appealable order.
We're here today, so I would assume it is an appealable order. I understand the lower courts have, the most recent cases I've found, they've now said, well, perhaps you haven't preserved your error because you didn't file a motion to reinstate after you were dismissed. The fundamental problem, I think, goes to the next issue, is that there's no facts there upon which to determine why it is you got forward out of court. You had no opportunity to know what's going on.
But with respect to the first problem, the plaintiff is in court.
Yes, sir. The plaintiff has filed a lawsuit.
And if he does not like the way that it has been disposed of, he's entitled to appeal.
That's correct. I would still maintain that the right, though, is to be able to get the other side in and have at least one hearing. And that goes to the second issue. This is a procedure which allows the court to dismiss a lawsuit without notice, without hearing, excuse me, and essentially without the other side even having to be present or do anything.
Ms. Brooks, you're not contending that the requirement of a hearing would necessitate a bench warrant to have the inmate at the Texas Department of Corrections physically present at the hearing, are you?
I don't believe so at the present time. I think what could be done is essentially what is done under the federal system. And I understand that this is basically, I believe we all understand that this law was passed in compliance with what we thought were the federal procedures to handle prisoner pro se. Although the cases there talk about, and there is a distinction under federal law by dismissing something under 12C, nevertheless, under the federal procedures, there is, in fact, some facts submitted to the court. You have the Spears procedure, where the magistrates go out and generate some evidence. You also have, apparently, there was some reference to a Walker questionnaire. So the court is not making its decision in a vacuum without facts.
Is it your position that the test is the same as it is under the federal cases, and that is whether the petition lacks an arguable basis in either law or fact?
I think that is the only one that's left, Your Honor. I think that all of us concede that 13001B3 is out. The Supreme Court, United States Supreme Court, has ruled on that. I believe this court has as well. In your Johnson v. Lineau decision, I believe you cast doubt on the first prong, so I think the only one that's left is the second prong, which is a no arguable basis in law or in fact. With a caveat, under these procedures and under the Texas procedure, where pleadings really aren't evidence, at the present time, and there's the Houston Court of Appeals has picked up on this in a recent decision in McDonald, is really all the court is going to be addressing is whether or not, as a matter of law, there is a basis upon which to maintain the lawsuit, because there aren't any facts.
Why can't the test be that if you take everything the plaintiff says as true in his petition, even if you take all of that as true, it will not prove a case on the law or the facts?
I think you can do that on the law. I think you have some problems doing that on the facts because you run into the concept that pleadings really do not establish facts. Now, you could theoretically, yes, you could take everything in there as true, but I don't think... The problem is you need to be able... Texas has come up with special exceptions and summary judgment procedures to address factual issues. This procedure essentially allows the court to circumvent those procedures and just say, I want to look at a bare bones pleading and determine whether or not this establishes a factual basis.
But if a plaintiff pleads, for example, that a guard at the prison has looked at him in a way that he finds offensive, and therefore his Eighth Amendment rights have been violated, wouldn't that, if you take all of that as true, that he has a cause of action under the Eighth Amendment, that the guard really did look ugly at him, still, that under the case law, that's not enough to establish a cause of action?
I would still maintain that he's entitled to his day in court to develop the facts, to flesh that out. Essentially, if you adopt your approach, it seems to me that what will happen is a prisoner will only plead, my rights to not suffer cruel and unusual punishment have been abridged, therefore I seek to recover.
Let's talk about this case. In this case, the Court of Appeals said that a noise-free prison environment is not a fundamental right. Are you here arguing against that proposition, that your clients are entitled to a noise-free environment?
I have addressed that in my brief. I think there is an arguable basis for that, but as I understand it, the court did not particularly want to address that issue, but I have done it in my brief. I believe that there is a cause of action pled in this case.
What standard would you have the court adopt?
With respect to?
Your noise-free environment.
I'm sorry, are you talking about a wanton disregard under a prisoner status? Or?
Yes.
I think in this situation, you have that. The record on the pleadings, and again, we're talking about only pleadings. The record on the pleadings shows that the prison officials acknowledge they have a problem, but they just don't know how to control it. So if you establish that somebody doesn't have to, we're talking about prisoners that work night shift, that when they come in, these televisions are blaring. They cannot sleep. If you determine that sleep deprivation and excessive noise is a cause of action which can be remedied, then in this case at least, the prison officials have almost conceded that in fact they know about the situation, they just feel powerless and helpless to do anything about it. Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. Court is ready to hear argument from respondents.
If please the court, respondents will be represented by Mr. Adrian Young.
Good morning. I want to suggest one thing that bears on a question that was asked just a moment ago of my good colleague, Barry Brooks. The record of the pleadings that Mr. Brooks referred to as being some indication of wanton indifference or deliberate disregard of the prisoner's rights simply does not support the conclusion of any deliberate indifference. The plaintiff, by his own pleadings and by the exhibits that he attached to his original complaint in this case, shows us that the prison officials and specifically the defendant, Jerry Peterson, who was the warden at that time at the Ellis 1 unit, was doing what he could to remedy this problem, recognized that there was a problem with TV noise on the cell runs, and was doing what he could within his power to remedy that problem. And I believe subsequent pleadings by the petitioner, if not in this case, in one of the other four cases that he brought concerning this very claim, has informed us that they have pretty much taken care of the problem.
Well, counsel, I think primarily what the court's interested in is the procedural problems, the allegations of denial of due process and violation of the open courts provision of the Texas Constitution. Can you explain why this type of case could not be handled in the traditional manner by special exceptions and by motion for summary judgment in a manner that would implicate, as the petitioner claims, those due process and open court rights?
I appreciate that, and I think that it certainly can be, but there should not be a requirement that it must be in every case, because some cases you're going to find it so patently frivolous that it is a waste of judicial and everybody else's resources to undertake the hearing procedures that may be called for in some cases. And I think Justice Heck's point is well taken, that the determination of frivolousness is a determination on the merits of the cases, which is fully reviewable on appeal as a matter of law, and it can be reviewed all the way up to the Texas Supreme Court.
Excuse me, I must have missed something somewhere. Why is this frivolous?
This particular case? In our view, it's frivolous because an inmate in the Texas prison system simply doesn't have a right to a noise-free environment.
I don't know if anyone was requesting a noise-free environment. A prisoner is a little different situation than an ordinary citizen, and he lacks mobility. He can't get away from the noise. They have to work. They have to keep hours. They have to be in certain places at certain times. They're supposed to sleep at certain times, as argued by the other side. And if you have 45 television sets blaring from 7 o'clock in the morning to 11 o'clock at night, sometimes as late as 1:30 in the morning, how are they supposed to do that?
Well, I think that that is a problem, and was recognized to be a problem by the warden of the unit, and it
does
address that problem.
Does that make it frivolous?
I don't think that...
I don't understand what makes this case frivolous when someone is a prisoner. In some societies throughout history, noise has been used as a method of torture. Sleep deprivation has been used as a method of torture. I'm not suggesting that that's the case here, but it might amount to the same thing if someone has to work, say, during the night, and you have five television sets blaring within sound of each other, sometimes between the different channels, at very high decibel rates, and with the other noise that normally goes on around you, how the heck are you supposed to get any sleep?
Well, if this case amounts to torture, it would not be frivolous, but, and this is a judgment
call. Well, it doesn't have to reach that level, does it?
Well, perhaps not. I think it's a judgment call at what level it has, TV noise in prison has to reach to for an inmate to have a cause of action arising therefrom.
Well, if it's a judgment call, how does it get dismissed as frivolous?
Well, you have to look at each case on its own merits, I believe, and some cases are going to be frivolous and some not. For example, an inmate claims that the guards are retaliating against him because he's a writ writer because they've given him dirty looks.
We're talking about this case.
Okay.
How does it get dismissed as frivolous when the court has no facts before it?
By simply looking at the pleadings and determining that under the facts that are alleged, if you assume them to be true.
What was alleged in this case that the trial court could have determined was frivolous?
That the TVs were on at all hours of the day, that they were too loud, and that this inmate suffered some loss of sleep and anxiety and such as that as a result of it.
I'm sorry, I don't understand what makes that frivolous.
As I say, in my view, it's, and in the court's, in several other courts' view, it's been a judgment call that that is, in fact, frivolous. If this court wants to determine that that is not a frivolous, that TV noise in prison under the facts of this case, as alleged, assuming the plaintiff's petition is
You've already acknowledged
true.
That the prison system itself, the warden, has acknowledged that there was a problem and that he was taking steps to correct it. And hopefully by now it's been corrected.
Well, the fact that there is a problem in many areas of prison life does not give an inmate a cause of action arising from that problem.
Depends on who's losing the sleep, doesn't it?
Well, I think that this court may determine that this case, if this court so chooses to determine that this is not a frivolous lawsuit, this court can reverse the trial court and the appellate court's decision. But that doesn't have anything to do with the constitutionality of this particular scheme. And I understood that that's what we were here on.
Counsel, I don't think we want to decide whether the TV sets were on too loud or they were not on too loud. The fact is if this petitioner were not a pauper, that you wouldn't be entitled to judgment strictly on the basis of his initial pleading. You'd have to file special exceptions and give him an opportunity to plead some facts so he could stay in court. If you were successful, or once those exceptions were granted, then you could file a motion for summary judgment, and on the basis of summary judgment evidence, have the matter finally disposed of. Why shouldn't that be the practice for a pauper under these circumstances?
Well, if you assume that he has not filed a frivolous case, then obviously he is entitled to.
Well, if you were a private litigant and filed a lawsuit, there's no way any court could, on the basis of an initial pleading, dismiss your lawsuit as being frivolous. Could they?
I understand.
I mean, the opposing counsel would have to file exceptions, given them an opportunity to replead, and then file a motion for summary judgment, correct?
That's correct. The reason for the statutory scheme is, however, as this court, I think, knows, that the pauperous litigant does not have a disincentive for filing a, and particularly inmates. They simply do not have the disincentive that other people naturally have by virtue of the fact that other people have to pay filing fees and attorney's fees and such as that, and are subject to in this state, Rule 13 sanction, the pauperous litigants and primarily the inmates that we have to deal with are not affected by these disincentives one way or the other. And it, as the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals has pointed out in the Pew versus St. Tammany case, this is the only way we, and in other cases, this is the only way the courts have to, in effect, equalize the treatment between the indigent and the not indigent litigants.
If the inmate, because his pauper status, can file repeated frivolous lawsuits, doesn't the court have other ways of sanctioning?
Well, I think that the court does, and certainly the court, several courts in several cases have used other methods, but these methods, such as Rule 13 sanctions, are not generally effective. In some cases, they are.
Well, counsel, why can't we, so we can dismiss a case that is frivolous in the sense that it's a repetitive filing on the same cause of action, much as the United States Supreme Court just dismissed the Zatko case, right, under its own rule. But this doesn't involve a repetitive filing, does it?
This case?
Yes.
Yes, it certainly does.
On the same cause of action?
In our view, yes.
Is that in the record?
It was referred to in the Court of Appeals decision. There was not a record made in this particular case of the fact that he had the other litigation. Some of the other litigation has occurred after he filed this suit.
Well, I think there was a reference to some federal litigation.
There is a federal case, and there is there were two cases out of Walker County, the same cause of action, and subsequently to their filing, Mr. Johnson filed a case in Travis County, which was dismissed, was appealed to the third court here in Austin. About a month ago, that was the dismissal was affirmed, and the mandate has issued in that case. So this thing has been decided to be frivolous by any number of courts already. I suppose it's this court's prerogative, addressing Justice Gamage's point a moment ago, that maybe it's not frivolous. But that has nothing, in our view, that has nothing to do with the statutory scheme. That's whether it's constitutional.
Our rules don't require pleading of evidence ordinarily. How can you tell from notice pleadings whether a case has no arguable basis in law or fact?
These are fairly specific pleadings. They're fairly well-written pleadings. And I don't see how we can get around just making a judgment call. Under these pleadings, accepted as true, is it frivolous or is it not frivolous to claim that an inmate have a right to something less than the noise level that I have pled by virtue of the TVs in the hall at the LS1 unit?
If a plaintiff pleaded that excessive noise in prison was indicative of wanton indifference on the part of officials in violation of his constitutional rights, and that's all he pleaded, could that be dismissed?
In our view, he has to have specific fact pleadings. I think in this case he probably does, although his specific facts do not indicate deliberate indifference. They, in fact, indicate the opposite. But
when you say he has to have, you mean without those pleadings, the trial court could not dismiss it?
I'm sorry, I did not hear that last
When you point. Say he has to have, you don't mean the rules require it. You mean without such pleadings, the trial court could not dismiss. Is that what you mean?
Without specific fact pleadings, the trial court can dismiss.
It can dismiss.
In our view, because that encompasses the defendant's official immunity, and we believe that there is a heightened pleading requirement. There aren't many Texas cases on that point, if any. There are any number of federal court cases on the point which do observe that the government official's immunity encompasses the requirement of a heightened or a more specific fact pleading than you're going to get in your ordinary case.
Did you all plead immunity in this case?
The immunity was not pled in this case.
There were no special exceptions?
There were no special exceptions.
As a practical matter, if this particular statute were not in place as violative of the Constitution and you had to operate without it, what difference would it make?
Well, there was some question about that, I think, when the statute, or when this particular chapter was written. We are probably of the view that the court has inherent jurisdiction to dismiss frivolous lawsuits, but This was at least an attempt to provide the courts with an explicit basis of jurisdiction to dismiss frivolous suits and also to provide some specific criteria based on the federal model.
Well, let me maybe change the question then to what alternative do you have to deal with these frivolous suits along the lines that Judge Cornyn asked you about earlier, using summary judgment or special exceptions, as you would with any litigant who filed a lawsuit that had no merit, as distinguished from this dismissal without consideration of the lawsuit on its merits at all?
Well, that last statement I would have to disagree with. This is an adjudication on the merits, which, as I say, the court can agree with or disagree with, but a determination of frivolousness is an adjudication on the merits. And certainly there's nothing wrong, and we do it every day in these inmate cases and in other cases, hold hearings on motions for summary judgment and special exceptions and the like. But certainly the court will recognize that there are any number of, let's say, inmate cases that are so patently frivolous. An inmate brings a claim that they took away my toothbrush last night and I wasn't able to brush my teeth until this morning. Surely we don't have to give a hearing on every one of these cases, provide a hearing, because if you require, and this I think addresses Judge Cornyn's point in part, if you require the judges in every case, even the most patently frivolous, to provide a hearing process, effectively, I think that does require the inmate's presence, because in this case, for example, the inmate did get a hearing. He may have gotten it back in chambers, but he did get a hearing. It was done in his absence. And I think most judges that we practiced before in the trial court level are going to bench one the inmate up. That entails all sorts of security and other problems, and I think what you'll find is that nothing will happen, and the cases will truly backlog. And the whole point, or at least one of the primary functions of this statutory scheme, is to allow us to separate the wheat from the chaff and to get down to the meritorious indigent cases. And that is, and I will tell you from proven experience, and the federal courts can tell you this too, that is the only way you will get to the meritorious prisoner cases, because you're deluged with these cases. You are just simply swamped with them if you don't have some mechanism by which to get rid of the patently frivolous without, as harsh as it may seem, without a hearing.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Mr. Brooks, are there any kinds of prisoner cases that could be dismissed without a hearing and still be constitutional under the statute in your opinion? Or do all of them require a hearing?
I think all of them will require some sort of hearing or factual determination.
So if a prisoner pleads that I was deprived of the use of my toothbrush last night, that would require a hearing?
Yes, sir. And the reason for that is something that you also touched upon. If in this case, Daniel Johnson had paid the filing fee, this could not be happening to him. The question is simply, if someone cannot afford to pay the filing fee, do they have to be taken out of loop and put into this procedure? And I do not believe the Texas Constitution provides for that happening.
Does that mean then he has to be out of TDC on a bench warrant to be present for that proceeding?
No, sir. Summary judgment can be done on affidavits. The federal system uses magistrate systems, referencing to magistrates. There's also, there's some reference to a Walker questionnaire. They're fleshed out. There are procedures available to develop the facts and to give the pauper plaintiff an opportunity to develop their facts. And that's what I'm arguing, is that it's a pauper plaintiff has the right to develop the facts just as a paying plaintiff does.
Counsel, let me ask you a question. Do you know, for any time period you care to choose, what percentage of the cases were summarily dismissed under Section 13.001?
The only indication I have of that, Your Honor, are the Court of Appeals decisions since, I guess, about in the last year. Everyone I could find, save one, has been summarily dismissed. There is one case out there. It's an interesting case. It's the case out of Houston, McDonald versus Houston Dairy, 813 Southwest 2nd, 238. It was just decided at the first Houston court here in August. It's the first time that prisoners have sued non-prison officials. And essentially the court there said because we don't have the facts, we have to look and see whether or not they have stated a cause of action at law. In that case, they had sued a dairy company for what they believed was tainted milk. The court said as a matter of law, a consumer can sue a producer for bad product, therefore we think your suit can go ahead. But other than that, everything I've found indicates that these suits have been summarily dismissed.
How many? What is the number that you're talking about?
I'd say about seven or eight that have made it to the appellate courts. I appreciate Mr. Young's experience. I don't practice in prisoner litigation, so I don't know the inside facts of what's really going on and the war stories as to what's actually happening out there.
Counsel, what the court's trying to determine, among other things, is Section 13.001 being abused and simply being used as a method to clear the court's docket?
I think it's being abused because I don't think it should be used in the first place. But more than that, it appears your decisions you're seeing are essentially just mimeographing the same decision from the last time. I don't think there's really any observing of what the facts are. They may change one paragraph here, one paragraph there, but in one of them, I believe it's the Waco Court of Appeals, issued three decisions back to back that essentially were the same decision. I don't even think they really changed but the names of the parties. So I don't believe that they're really looking at the facts. And the problem you've got is you've essentially created a catch-22 for the pauper prisoner. As Justice Heck points out, if someone would just file a notice pleadings, they would probably be better off than to file these massive federal court-type pleadings that set forth in detail what their complaint's about. So I don't think the courts of appeals are reading them and looking at them. They're taking a cursory look and say, well, this prisoner is appealing because one of them's caused, he says the guard put his finger on his nose. Now, perhaps that's frivolous. But the problem is, if that prisoner had paid a filing fee, this couldn't be happening to him.
But if he paid a filing fee, he'd be sanctioned.
That's true. And should be. No doubt about it.
Isn't that a trade-off? Isn't that a legitimate procedural trade-off?
The problem, as I see it, is he's still, everyone that comes to court should be entitled to notice and hearing of what's going to happen to him.
Contrast for me, if you would. You can take the toothbrush case. You can take something even more extreme, like the warden won't organize an invasion force of bars.
Okay.
And that claim is filed. How, if this statute's not in place, do you think that should be handled?
The court under Rule 13 has the ability on its own motion to bring in any parties after notice and hearing to determine whether or not there is good faith pleadings, whether or not this is in fact frivolous. Actually, that statute defines groundlessness. To me, it's a very excellent definition. This court added specifically the notice and hearing provisions to that rule. I think that is an appropriate way to handle it. The court can do that. I do not believe it has to be done by a live proceeding. I believe the court on its own motion could direct the parties to respond as to why this case should not be dismissed as groundless. And once that response is made, then the court can make the determination. It's only that determination should not be made against pauper litigants without them having their day in court.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument in the first call. The court will take a brief recess.
Please rise.